Thank you. Okay, I'm sure that more people will ultimately get folded in, but I'm John Beck, and I co-direct our Daily Worker Daily Lives, which for nearly 21 years now has been exploring the intersection of culture and work here at Michigan State University through film showings, poetry and fiction readings, exhibits, concerts, and we're in the 17th year in our Brown Bag series, and we're very happy to share this Brown Bag series with the Library Colloquia series that Michael does such a wonderful job coordinating. So before I simply introduce our wonderful speakers slash performers slash extraordinary folks to you, let me just say that unfortunately our presentation at the end of the month got changed. So Dylan Minor will not be doing his presentation on the 1937 sit-down strike in Flint. Instead, I'm forced to do a presentation. I've only done two presentations over 17 years, so this will be the third. And at the end of the month, November 28th, on a Wednesday, we'll be back across the street in the MSU Museum Auditorium, where I'll be talking about a traveling exhibit and also doing a number of things in relation to it from the Smithsonian called The Way We Worked. And that talk is called The Culture and History of Work, Workers, and the Workplace. And as Bill just pointed out, could I pick something more broad, perhaps? So I've handed out flyers for those. I also sent around our Spring Brown Bag series. So put it on your refrigerator, circle them on your calendar, and do show up. We'd love to have you here. One of those will be another musical one here in this room on March 22nd when Dennis Stromat will be here. These musical brown bags are because of a relationship that we've had over the years with the 10-pound fiddle. And we have many fiddle folks, I think, who are here in the audience today. The fiddle has been a wonderful cooperating group with us in relation to having us be able to hitchhike on the back of them bringing in wonderful performers, those who have had some kind of relationship to the work of the world of work and labor in their music are the ones that we choose then to work with. Now there are sign-in sheets. I'm going to just hand it, and you just if you haven't signed in, it'll work its way through, snake its way through. So we are so happy to have Sparky and Rhonda Rucker here with us today. First time that I met and heard Sparky was at Highlander Education Research Center in East Tennessee. And Highlander was one of the folk schools, one of the labor schools here in the United States, where first they really looked at very purposefully the whole notion of how do we mix songs and other theater and other kinds of cultural things, and how do we mix those with our organizing in such a way to bring the real kind of story across to people. And nothing inspires, nothing really brings out the passion in people like music does. And it's not only about passion, it's about solidarity. It's about the ability to have something that we can all can sing, a refrain that we all learn. The way that Pete Seeger, for many of us, has taught us all to by speaking the words as he's going along in the performance. This is going to be a wonderful time for all of us together, so please help me in welcoming Sparky and Rhonda Rucker to Michigan State University to talk about and sing about changing the world one song at a time, songs of work and struggle. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, John, and thank you. Because if you didn't show up, we'd just be singing to chairs. You know, as John mentioned, music has always been part of every struggle this nation, this world has ever seen. Because one thing as a historian, one thing I've learned as I study acts of bravery is that it's not the Arnold Schwarzeneggers of the world who say, I can slay the dragon. but it's the brave little tailor from old folk songs, or the little trickster Jack that actually slays the dragon even though he's scared to death. But he does it anyway. That's where bravery comes in. When the old martyrs of old were being sent to the arenas to be devoured by the lions, they would go in singing. When the thousands and thousands of troops in the Civil War, no matter which side you fought on, marched into battle in straight lines, even though they knew that the first few ranks of men would be mown down like new wheat, but they would continue to charge. Quite often they marched into battle singing. When we in the civil rights movement faced up to Bull Connor and the dogs and the water hoses, we did it singing. And when we were in jail, we sang to let each other know, hey, I'm just in the cell next to you, down the hall. So music's always been part of the struggles. And so we're going to just do some songs and talk about this country, the nation founded on freedom. Yet and still, by the end of the Civil War, there were over 4 million Africans enslaved in this land of the free, home of the brave. Well, I'm gonna walk the streets of glory. Well, I'm gonna do that because I broke a string. And fortunately, you see there's a few others up here. You know, there was a, down in the city of Raleigh, North Carolina, just north of Raleigh, is a river that runs out to the ocean. The name of that river is called the Tar River. What's it called?
Tar River.
The Tar River. The reason they call it the Tar River is because in that area of North Carolina, there's a big swampy region called the Dismal Swamp. I love the name of that. You know. Bad enough that you got a swamp, but what do you call it? The Dismal Swamp. Double jeopardy. That's because for over eons, carbon-based life forms died there. And under the eons, the pressure produced tar, and it leaches into the water. The old slaves used to sing a song, "The old Tar River's gonna run tomorrow." Tar River runs every day. But they were talking about themselves. We're black like tar, and we're gonna run tomorrow. And a lot of the old songs during slave times were songs that were not only songs that talked about how bad things were, but they were songs that gave people the hint that there was help along the way. And that Tar River was actually an underground railroad route. Many of the underground railroad routes in that area of the world led out to the coast, and people would find ways to take passage to go north. It's one thing that Frederick Augustus Bailey did, who later changed his name to Douglas. He went out to the coast and caught a ship and took him up to Massachusetts and Connecticut in that area, and where he worked as a man who was a caulker on ships. So maybe you'll sing this song with us. I learned this song from Bessie Jones. I learned it at Highlander, in fact. Bessie Jones was a really fine singer who, not Bessie Smith, some people think I'm talking about, but Bessie Jones was a fine woman from South Carolina, from one of the Gullah people down there. She and John Davis and Mabel Hillary, a lot of those singers were aptly notated in the research of one of the finest folks in to come down the pike, a good friend of old John and mine, a guy named Guy Carawan. Guy Carawan was one of the people that took the song We Shall Overcome and then made it copyrighted it so that the money coming in from We Shall Overcome could raise money into a fund called the We Shall Overcome Fund. And they use it to fund singing events during the movement, and they still use it to fund African-American musical events in the South. And Guy Carawan was one of my first mentors. I was about 11 or 12 years old when I met him. But he did a lot of research down in the Georgia Sea Islands and wrote some fine books talking about that culture. But Bessie taught me this song. Said the song was a call and response song. So that's reason I need your help singing this song. Will you help me sing this song?
Sure.
Otherwise, you're going to be still down there picking cotton, you know. So you'll help me do this song. All right. Well, the call is, way down yonder in the old Tar River. And the response is, ooh-wee. Can you do that?
Ooh-wee.
I feel like Gladys Knight. And you're the pips. Then the other, and old Tar River's gonna run tomorrow. And you go, oh Lord, I'm talking about a river.
Oh Lord, I'm talking about a river.
I better raise it a little bit. Way down yonder in the old Tar River.
Ooh, we
say, old Tar River gonna run tomorrow.
Oh Lord, I'm talking about a river.
Way down yonder in the old Tar River.
Ooh, we
say, old Tar River run tomorrow.
Oh Lord, I'm talking about a river.
I'm gonna hop along, skip along the old Tar River. Tomorrow.
Oh Lord, I'm talking about a river.
I got a letter from Major Bailey.
Ooh,
he said the old Tar River gonna run tomorrow.
Oh Lord, I'm talking about a river.
Oh Tar River gonna water my cattle. Runs black and dirty.
Ooh-wee.
Hey, old Tar River gonna run tomorrow.
Oh Lord, I'm talking about a river.
One more way down yonder in the old Tar River. Tar River gonna run tomorrow. Oh Lord, I'm talking about a river. Yeah, good singing.
We're going to do a camp meeting song for you. Camp meetings came out of my home state of Kentucky around 1800 out of the Presbyterian Church. Now, who would have thunk it? Presbyterians camping. I mean, that gives me all sorts of images of RVs in a row, sending out for sushi and... But it really did start in the Presbyterian Church, and it's all because they invited this really great speaker to come and so many people showed up that they couldn't fit everybody inside the church. So they said, you know, it's a nice day in July. Let's just go outside on the grounds. So they had a really nice gathering outside. And then they decided to do it overnight and have camping. And then they, you know, bring their meals, like their fried chicken and potato salad and things like that. And then the Baptist heard about it. And the Baptists started doing it. And I guess they added a few dishes in there, too. And then the Methodists heard about it. Funnel cakes. Yeah, and the Methodists, I guess they added their casseroles. And then they also added a lot of singing. You know, those Methodists can sing. I grew up in the Methodist church. And so they had, you know, some great trading back and forth of songs at these camp meetings. The Methodists, by the way, are the ones that continued the tradition the longest. Some of them are still doing it. And that's why today, when you think of camp meetings, you don't think of Presbyterians. You think of Methodists. But the Methodist church had a lot of singing, and that there weren't just a lot of, you know, there were a lot of European Americans that came to these camp meetings, but there were also African Americans at these camp meetings. Now, the European Americans would bring their old-time hymns, you know, the ones I'm talking about, the four verses and the amen at the end. Amen, not amen, amen. I grew up singing those. None of them had choruses, but they would sing those songs. But then the African Americans would bring their old-time spirituals, things like Wade in the Water, things like Joshua Fit the Battle of Jericho. You know the ones I'm talking about. And the white people would hear those songs, and they'd say, oh, that's a great song, and they'd sing along. And the African Americans, they would hear those old hymns that the white people were singing. And they'd say, oh, I know a chorus that'll go with that. And they'd add a chorus to it. So there was a lot of trading back and forth, a lot of great musical exchange at these camp meetings. And one of the songs that they used to do is one that we're going to do for you. The verses were written by an English Baptist minister named Samuel Stennett. But the chorus is an old Underground Railroad chorus. And the reason we know that is because it's got all those code words in it. Now, you know what I'm talking about, right? And the code words in the Underground Railroad. I mean, they couldn't just sing a song saying, we're going to escape tomorrow, right? The slave owners weren't that dumb. So they decided that they would, you know, they would put some code words in there. So they'd say things like, we're going to the promised land, meaning we're going to escape tomorrow. Or, you know, we're going to Canaan's land. Canaan land meaning Canada, of course. I mean, they could come up here. They could go up to New York State. They go to Wisconsin, someplace like that, and they might be safe. But there was this nasty law called the Fugitive Slave Law, which meant that slave catchers could legally come up north, get you, and take you back down south if they found you. But if you made it up to Canada, Canada didn't recognize that law. So if you made it up to Canada, you were free. So that was always the goal, Canaan land or Canada. So anyway, this song's a good song for, in fact, they still sing it down our way. And if you know it, please sing along. And if you don't know it, please sing along. On Jordan's stormy banks I stand and cast a wishful eye to Canaan's fair and happy land where my possessions lie. I am bound for the promised land. I'm bound for the promised land. Their generous fruits that cannot fail on trees immortal grow. Their rocks and hills and brooks and vales
honey flow. I am bound for the promised land. I'm bound for the promised land.
Thanks for singing.
Well, this whole thing of a country founded on freedom, first document, all men, took a while for them to include women, are created equal with certain inalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Came to a head 80 some odd years into this nation's history. We went to war, a war in which close to 1 million Americans lost their lives. The official count of the soldiers has been revised up 750,000 to 800,000 soldiers. But it was a civil war. And in civil war, civilians die. You ain't got to believe me. Just look at what's going on in Syria today. Look at what happened in Sarajevo. Rwanda. Even those not killed directly by bullets flying, that happens. But in civil war, the infrastructure breaks down. And when infrastructure breaks down, see, that's the only thing that keeps us as a civilization is infrastructure. And once you destroy that, oh, I got a cold that normally the doctor could cure, but no, he's up to the front. Sawing off a few legs, you die. The people making sure the water's good to drink. Lord have mercy, and people do, but they have broken hearts. You know, I know for a fact, my daddy died December 5th, 2001. My mother died December 25th, 2001. They'd been married 60 years, and she said, this is why I got in this game. Now it's over. 1 million in a nation of 20 million. Think about what we did to our gene pool on that debacle. We're still suffering from it. Look at how the vote almost turned out. About halfway through the war, Frederick Douglass, who'd become a very good friend of Abraham Lincoln, said, "Abe, why are you trying to fight this war with one hand tied behind your back?" He said, "You got a whole lot of black folk that got a big vested interest in this war. You know, let the black man fight for his own freedom." And he kind of inched into it, being the good lawyer that he was. A man with hardly 12 months of education, one of the smartest people come down the pike. Sometimes genes will tell. And first, he waited for a good victory, quote unquote. When you got little Mac being the general, you know, you can't really call it a victory. You can call it, well, a stalemate, and the other side left the field first, so we won, you know. You must be a history nerd like me, so you got that joke, right? But anyway, signed the Emancipation Proclamation, which set free slaves held in the rebelling states, which is a good thing to do when you ain't got no control in the rebelling states and you pass a law, you know. But it meant that as the Union Army went south, it could set free. And he did it as an executive order. A lot of people don't understand this, and I'm going to take the time to try to explain this. He did it as a War Powers Act. And the only way he could do it legally, because there was some implied reason in the Constitution that you could have slaves. But as a War Powers Act, these people who are rebelling are using the slaves to build fortifications and to help the war effort so we can set those people free. Benjamin Butler called them contraband of war. And that's why all of a sudden they start calling black folks contraband. Didn't mean they could play fiddles and then, you know, dance. Sorry, but that's the way my mind works, and what pops in my head pops out of my mouth, all right? I long ago impeached the governor of my mind, thank goodness. But anyway, so old Abe signed that Emancipation Proclamation, and because it came into effect January 1st, 1863, they started recruiting black folks as they set them free. There were a whole bunch of liberals from the North, most of them Unitarians. You know, see them Unitarians? People like Thomas Wentworth Higginson, wonderful Unitarian minister, and also a very heavy intellectual, turned both Emily Dickinson and Louisa May Alcott into trying their hand at writing. But when he went down to South Carolina on that Port Royal experiment where they were trying to make sure that the slaves that were set free could be educated and come back into the society there and learn to speak English, because Gullah is a combination of English and Angolan. And he said, "Well, maybe I'll raise one of these regiments." And he was one of the first to raise a black regiment, the first South Carolina United States colored troops. There was a Jayhawker who had gone to battle with John Brown out there in Kansas and Missouri, a guy named James Montgomery. And he formed a unit called the 2nd United States Colored Troops. And they brought all sorts of teachers down to help them, and all sorts of workers.
Yeah. One of the people that was asked to come down was Harriet Tubman. And she went down there, and she had kind of a quiet start as a nurse, trying to, you know, just help in any way she could. But then they found out, lo and behold, she had special skills for slipping around in the woods and without getting detected, and she could slip behind enemy lines and not be detected. She was so good at it. So they asked her to work as a spy. And she went around on those plantations, and she found out where the rebels had planted torpedoes or mines in a particular river down there called the Combahee River. Now, it's spelled Combahee, C-O-M-B-A-H-E-E, but down there they pronounce it Combahee, the Combahee River. And she found out where they had planted those torpedoes. She delivered that information to the Union, and then the Union officers ended up saying, "I tell you what, we need a scout on an expedition to go pull up those mines." And guess who it was? It was Harriet Tubman. She went out, and she was the basically the leader on that expedition, on that raid. They call it the Cumbie River Raid. And the ships went up the river. They pulled up those mines. They destroyed bridges, destroyed property, put, you know, set things on fire, and just basically destroying what they could. And then ended up on either side of that river were plantations where slaves were working. And they saw these boats coming up the river. And word spread pretty fast that these were Union gunboats. These were friendly people. And all of a sudden, people started flocking down to the river to be rescued. And so they started taking them on board. People would, you know, get down to the water. They'd wade out to the boat, and they'd come up in there. They ended up rescuing over 750 slaves on that one expedition, more than twice the number she rescued just piecemeal, you know, on a piecemeal basis in her Underground Railroad work, which was great in and of itself. But then she went on this raid and rescued even more people. She told stories later on in her life about that raid. She was talking about how people would, you know, were gathering up all of their possessions. You know, a lot of people were carrying it on their heads, trying to make it down to the river. One person had a black pig and a white pig and got on board, and they named one Beauregard and one Jeff Davis. Jeff Davis. Had him with biscuits and gravy, maybe. Anyway, they were doing that, and then there was another woman that had a whole passel of kids. You know, she was trying to make it down to the boat, had on one of those long skirts of the day, you know, and was trying to pull that up, and she had a couple of kids in each hand, had a kid on her shoulders, but she had just cooked a big pot of rice, and she wasn't about to leave that behind for the rebels to eat, so she had that on her head, and she was trying to make it down there and had all these kids, you know. Well, the kid sitting on her shoulder started scooping that rice in his mouth, and Harriet was watching that as, you know, this woman trying to make it down to the river. But they rescued all these people, and of course, a lot of the people they rescued were men who ended up, you know, joining up to fight for their own freedom.
Trouble the water. Who are
must be the children of the Israelites. God's gonna trouble the water. Sing it with me, wait.
Our guitar player that can change his All right. Appreciate it.
Obviously, you don't know your own strengths.
Obviously, I'm always breaking my strings because I don't change them until they break.
That's one way to do it.
Well, what makes it funnier is we've been on the road for a month and we haven't broken any yet.
All you know of a why we broke some? Because we went by elderly in Boston.
Oh, yeah, we brought, but that's right.
It's all elderly's fault.
Yeah, got in town last night and said, well, we'll go by and stock up on strings. Now we're going to have to go back.
How many of these I can break?
I don't know. No, no. Please, no. Well, back in 1919, the 19th Amendment to the Constitution had just passed the U.S. legislature. That's the one granting women the right to vote. But then, as you probably know, it's difficult to pass an amendment in this country. That's not the end of the story. It's got to go out to all of the states to be ratified, every single one. So they got to go through all that to pass the amendment. So it all came down to one state, Tennessee.
Yay!
This is my PowerPoint back here. Anyway, it came down to Tennessee, and legislators all of a sudden, you know, that had been sitting on the fence, or that had been solidly for women's suffrage were sitting on the fence, or they had fled to the opposition. They all of a sudden were getting, you know, kind of chicken and not for it anymore. And they finally held a vote. And it was a tie. Now, by this time, it was August of 1920. So they needed one more vote, and they didn't know where they were going to get it. Well, there was a gentleman, a state representative named Harry Byrne, who was from McMinn County, Tennessee. Now, he was just down from us, I guess McMinn County's, 50 miles away or something like that from where we live in East Tennessee. In fact, Sparky's Rucker side of the family is from McMinn County. But Harry Byrne came in, and he had come in solidly against women's suffrage. He did not want this to happen. But then he also carried in his pocket a note from his mother, urging him to vote for the amendment. So in the end, when they had that vote, Harry Byrne voted to ratify the 19th Amendment. And that's why I got to vote in this U.S. election that we just had, or in all the elections. In fact, every time I go in the election booth, I think about those people and not just the women's suffrage people, but, you know, Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman, and all the other people that have died and, you know, or were beaten, John Lewis, people like that, that did all of this so we, so everybody, not just some people, but everybody could vote. And, you know, it's just so important. But anyway, they interviewed Harry Byrne after he voted to ratify that amendment. And he said, well, a mother's advice is always safest to follow. So I pull that one out every now and then on my son. Anyway, this is one of the songs that they used to sing in the suffrage movement. Let us rouse the nation, let our words all hearts inspire. Tardy legislation grants us all we may desire. Proclaim the truth both day and night, deny it if you can. But every woman has the right to vote as well as men. Come along, speak right and sing. Come and join the chorus, let the echoes ring. Keep the music rising with a swell on every note. But Uncle Sam is wise enough to give us all a vote. Our cause has fought its way despite the shafts of ridicule. And he who fights for a woman's rights no longer is called a fool. School suffrage has been meted out in states both east and west. And by persistent work, no doubt, we'll manage all the rest. Come along, speak right and sing. Come and join the chorus, let the echoes ring. Keep the music rising with a swell on every note. Till Uncle Sam is wise enough to give us all a vote. Come along, speak right and sing. Come and join the chorus. Sam is wise enough to give us all a vote. Thank you.
Augusta, Georgia, in Elkins, West Virginia. We quite often, when we're thinking about struggles, we forget about the things that the struggles have accomplished for us. You like taking the weekend off? Unions gave you that. You like working for a fair wage? Unions gave you that. Collectively, we've always been able to accomplish more than we can individually. And when the union started was, of course, when they got strong, was during the Depression. And the Depression caused a lot of people to change their way of living. People out in Oklahoma, when the drought, God, sort of sounds like last year, you know, depression, drought, no work. They heard that California was a Garden of Eden and it was blossoming and blooming and we can all go out and work. Of course, there's always more jobs advertised than there really are when people show up for them. Down south, places like Alabama, Georgia, and Mississippi, those people decided to give up farming and to try to head north to the urban areas, to the factories. Here there's work up there. They're making automobiles in Detroit. See, we always call it Detroit. Like pulpit, you know, you got to put the emphasis on the first one. So, up to Detroit, to Cleveland, to Chicago, they took the music with them. When they went to Chicago with those blues they were singing, it became that electrified sound. It became the Chicago blues, the stuff that was the forerunner of rock and roll. There was a man down in Mississippi named Big Bill Broomsey. He wrote a song about the folks hitting the road, talking about feeling locked up in poverty. When you're locked up, you're looking for a key to get out. And the way to get out was the highway. So he called that song The Key to the Highway. I learned this from a man who came out of Knoxville, Tennessee, named Brian McGee. Some of you may remember Brian McGee and Sonny Terry. I got to know those gentlemen. They were wonderful folks. I got the key to the highway. I'm booked, I've got to go. Gonna leave here running, 'cause walking's much too slow. The moon comes over the mountain, I'll be on my way. Gonna follow this old highway until the break of day. Key to the highway, I got the key to the highway. I'm booked, I've got to go. Gonna leave here running, 'cause walking's much too slow. Go ahead, Ryan. Just give me one kiss, baby. Before I go, 'cause when I leave this old town, you know I won't be back no more. Sing it with me. I got the key to the highway. I'm booked. I'm booked, I've got to go. Gonna leave here running, 'cause walking's much too slow. After working in the civil rights movement, for a time I taught school, but then I decided I wanted to take one of those, as we called them in the 60s, those vocations for social change. And I decided that I think I need to go free up white folk. White folk need to be set free. Lord knows, poor white folk in Southern Appalachia need to be free. They ain't got no excuses for failure, you know? So I took all my training, became a staff member for the Council of the Southern Mountains, working in eastern Kentucky and southwestern Virginia. And if you think facing up to the Klan and Nazi Party like I did in the Civil Rights Movement was scary, go up against Union gun thugs. Some of you may have seen a documentary called Harlan County, USA. I was in that area during all that time. Most of the people in that movie were people I worked with. Everybody's got a gun. And they don't just use them to shoot rabbits and squirrels. It was a scary time. But those times were always scary in those union struggles.
Back in 1931 in Harlan County in my home state of Kentucky, there was an outright war going on between the union leaders and the coal mining companies. And there was a woman that lived in Harlan County named Florence Reese. And her husband, Sam Reese, was a coal miner and he was a union leader. And there was also this nasty, no good sheriff in town named J.H. Blair. And he had all of his gun thugs with him and everything. And, you know, the mining companies would buy out the law enforcement officials, basically, is what would happen. Still happens. But anyway, they were coming to the Reese household one night, J.H. Blair and his cronies. They came there and knocked on the door looking for Sam, and he wasn't there, and Florence answered, and they ransacked the house looking for him, and then they set up watch outside the house. They were going to wait for him and gun him down when he came home. Remember, I told you this was a real honest-to-God war. And Sam, fortunately, kind of got wind of what was going on, and he made himself scarce that night. He didn't show up. But in the meantime, Florence Reese was left alone inside that house with her seven children waiting all night long with these guys outside and their guns. When things got tense in the middle of the night, she tore off a page of her wall calendar, and she wrote a song that became one of the most famous songs to come out of the labor movement. In fact, about 30 years or so later, they changed the words to it, and they sang it in the civil rights movement. This is Florence Reese's version.
Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you?
tell of how the good old Union has come in here to dwell. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Florence Reese.
Thank you.
I always put down more songs than I got time for, so I got to figure out what we could do, because I know we want to have some time for a question and answer. Although I gave you every answer. I don't know why you'd have a question, but do you a couple more songs here. Back in, I think, 1982, kind of hard to know anymore. As I get older, those, unless it happened 150 years ago, I can't remember precisely what it was. But I was asked to perform a song that had been written by the one of the producers at Channel 8, which was a PBS station in Nashville. And I'd been working with the Southern Folk Cultural Revival Project. God, how can you say all that stuff? It was an outgrowth of SSOC, SOC, Southern Students Organizing Committee. Boy, see there, everything breaks when I'm... And it's all part of the act. My wonderful friend, Anne Romaine, who she and Bernice Regan started that organization, and it was composed of all the people who had been the folk singers that had come down during the Civil Rights Movement. People like Pete Seeger and Guy Carawan and even Bob Dylan at one time, and Gil Turner, Lynn Chandler, Bernice Regan. You may know her as the woman that started the African-American woman singing group, the Sweet Honey and the Rock. Of course, Bessie Jones and the Georgia Sea Island Singers, and Reverend Pearlie Brown, the man that taught me how to play bottleneck slide guitar. I mean, all these wonderful, Johnny Shines, who had been a contemporary of Robert Johnson, was also, that's how I met him, was being part of that organization. And we would just do these concerts throughout the South, singing at the rallies and whatnot. And so after the passage of the Civil Rights Bill in 65, we tried to keep the music going, letting Southerners hear their music. Not the music that Tin Pan Alley told them was their music, but the music of the people. And we would go around to Southern colleges and letting them see that we could be a both black and white and Native American group of musicians on stage together. It was a wonderful experience. Some of the best playing I ever did was during that time. But anyway, we were asked to do this TV show called Catch the Spirit. And they said, asked me if I'd sing this song, and the chorus is one we all know. It's called The Ballad of Martin Luther King. He preached about love, read from the Bible. His words rang out like an old-time revival. He said you will need courage, but you do not need a gun. We shall overcome. They fell in line behind him, walking shoulder to shoulder. From a jail in Birmingham, he said it is not over. Pray, sisters, pray, brothers, all the way to Washington. We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome.
shall overcome someday. Oh, deep in my heart, I know that I do believe that we shall overcome someday. Then one day in Memphis, skies turned gray. In the blinking of an eye, his dream was blown away. But if you can remember what that man has done, let's all sing, we shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome someday. Ballad of Martin Luther King by Bill Dale. Thank you.
Well, we're going to, on a trip next year that we wanted to mention to you, we're going to Ireland, and it's a music, sightseeing, and history tour. And you're invited to go. We can take 20 people. It's just a small tour. But if you're interested in this, we've got some green sheets over here.
Green sheets. You see, we're prepared.
Yeah. So pick one up or talk to us, and we'll tell you about it. Something that I think we sometimes forget is, you know, when we're talking about struggles and trials and tribulations, is sometimes there's good news. And good news is awfully hard to come by sometimes, especially when you're talking about the environment. And but I ran across something recently that there's a river down our way called the Pigeon River.
You had me worried.
Yeah. There's a river down our way called the Pigeon River, and it was... it's been polluted quite a bit by a paper mill. And they interviewed a scientist who basically, you know, said it was a dead river and there was, you know, don't introduce any animals in there. They'll die and that kind of stuff. Well, they introduced some regulations through the legal system. And it ended up cleaning up that river because the paper mill couldn't put all that stuff back in the river. So it ended up cleaning up the river. Now they can put, you know, the species of fish and other things that used to be in there. And the scientist was talking about it and say, you know, it used to be dead. Now it's a living river. It's a stream that's alive. It, you know, and you just don't run across those things too often. And you know, sometimes we do treat this planet like we've got someplace else to go. And, you know, like we've got another something waiting for us or whatever. But this last song that we're going to do for you is one that I wrote a few years ago. And it's on the newest CD that we have available over here called One Earth. It's the title song. From the mountain flows like a river, then cools in Earth's early morn. sun's creation and earth's liberation and unbridled beauty is born. Time never ending, with a will unbending, passes through perils unknown. One earth to cherish and one earth to cling to, and one earth to have is our home. And the whale in the wide open sea, crystal capped mountains to clear rolling rivers so wild, unfettered and free, delicate balance of poised out in space all alone. One earth to cherish and one earth to cling to, and one earth to have is our home. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us.
Okay, so this means that if you've got questions, they've got answers, or if you have comments, they've got open ears. And let me just remind you, if you haven't signed in, sign in. Tonight, the 10-pound fiddle concert is at 8 o'clock, right? Remember that, Ray? And at the UU Church, right? Unitarian Church near the East Lansing Public Library. And there are flyers available for our brown bag on the 28th and for next semester's brown bag. So, with that, let me hand the microphone to anyone who has a comment or a question. Raise your hand. Comments or questions? Comments or questions? Okay, over to Michael. This is an exercise program for fat guys like me.
I just want to ask Berkey what his job was in the Harlan County situation.
What was your exact?
I was an organizer. I was in the, like I said, on the staff of the Council of the Southern Mountains. And what that was, it was an organization that, it was an umbrella organization that was a communications organ for things like Commission on Religion in Appalachia, Highlander Research and Education Center, the SOCM, Save Our Cumberland Mountains, Miners for Democracy, the Black Lung Association, Welfare Rights Organization. And we published a magazine called Mountain Life and Work that was a weekly publication that basically told people what was going on so they could hear the news as opposed to just the right-wing news that was going on at the time. And one of the things we accomplished was we got Arnold Miller elected to head the UMWA, ousting Tony Boyle. I don't know if you remember this, but Tony Boyle had killed Jock Yablonski and his family and taken over the UMWA. And we were working with the Miners for Democracy and Harry Patrick and Arnold Miller, and he was the next head of the union. So we were instrumental in helping that to happen. Also, we were instrumental in helping black lung be associated as a real disease that could be treated as opposed to something that the health insurance companies wouldn't, they didn't even recognize that black lung was a disease at that time. We also helped people in those areas because of the depression in that area to be able to get their welfare rights, the various fundings that they need to survive, food stamps and whatnot. And as I said, we were organizing. We would go around helping the various union chapters have some strength in terms of bringing music for their rallies when they. But let me tell you, like I said, there were lots of. If you saw that film, there were a lot of people that got killed during that time. It was a very scary time. I had to leave under cover of darkness because, needless to say, there were over a million African Americans living in Southern Appalachia. But most of them were invisible. They lived in what they call colored, and that's saying that very nicely, colored with an N, hollers. And here I was living in the town and had, like I said, stood up to the Klan and to the Nazis. I thought I was something, you know, and then these people had more guns than the Nazis and the Klan had. And they also had a lot of dynamite that they were using to blow up people's houses and stuff. It was pretty scary. But I live to tell the tale.
Okay, other questions or comments? Raise your hand. Any others? Okay.
Yes, you will. Just tell us,
yeah. You bet. Well,
either that or you're just not interested.
Let us give them another wonderful round of applause for that great.
Thank you so much. And we're sorry about the technical difficulties we have with the strings. We do have CDs up here. If you'd like to take us home, you don't have to feed the CD.